Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast, talking all things movement, whole food nutrition and environmental wellness with your hosts, Ben and Emma.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 5. My name is Ben Adelberg and joined, as always, by my co-host, Emma Strutt. Hello, Emma.
G'day, Ben. How are you going?
Very good, thank you.
How's the recovery going?
Going good, going good. And on that note, the fundraiser for the Native Forest Restoration Trust has now closed, and we have raised a grand total, bang on, $1,000. So amazing. So thank you so much to each and every one of our listeners that made their contribution. That money has now gone directly to the Native Forest Restoration Trust for their work in, establishing and protecting the little pockets of native forest and wetlands. So, yeah, amazing stuff. And again, thank you so much to everyone that's made their contribution.
Yep, huge thank you. Great way to take action, so appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so before we dive into the episode, just a couple of quick little things. We've got a little bit of a reminder. We've mentioned this once before, but if you're enjoying our podcast and you find the website content useful, please consider buying us a coffee. So what does that mean, Ben?
Well, let me give a little bit of a background to that. So like Emma said, if you're enjoying the podcast and finding all our content useful, we would love it if you'd consider supporting our work by buying us a coffee. Now, the Lentil Intervention itself derives no money. There is no income. We make no money from this. But of course, it's done purely out of passion. But it does consume a fair amount of our time. And we've got more that we would love to do. And in fact, there's a couple of projects we're going to soon kick off. So to be able to dedicate more of it, we do have some costs to cover. And some of these projects will require a little bit of funding. So any support gained will help us. So either follow the link in our show notes or head on over to our website. And on the top, you'll see a little coffee mug icon. Click on that and it'll take you to the buy me a coffee rather portal, and it'll tell you a little bit more about what we're trying to achieve. Now, lastly, we are going to be talking about a newly released book titled Nature and Wellbeing, Aotearoa, which I have personally read cover to cover, and it was perfectly timed with my final big training runs and, of course, the event itself, spending many hours in different forests such as the Redwoods and Tarawera Forest, and so on. So it really, really made me appreciate even more how special it is to be immersed in these forests. So if you haven't yet, after listening to this episode, buy yourself a copy. So Emma, time to bring in our next guest and author of this wonderful book.
Today we are joined by environmental historian Dr. Catherine Knight. Professionally, Catherine wears many impressive hats. Not only is she an environmental historian, but she's a yoga teacher, an award-winning non-fiction author. She spearheads KHM Consulting and is also the co-founder of Better Futures Forum. Catherine recently published her latest book, which examines the link between nature and well-being, and she is now challenging all New Zealanders to contemplate a nature-rich future, which is, of course, just as important for us Aussies over the ditch, so everyone tuning in today will find value in today's conversation. Catherine, thank you for joining us.
Oh, nice to be here with you both. Well, virtually.
Yes, that's true, Catherine. So just like all good stories, we like to first get to know a little bit more about our guests themselves. I presume there'll be a direct link with some of the books that you've written. But tell us a little bit about your background and, of course, your passion for the environment.
Sure. Well, it's I'll try to make this punchy and succinct, but I'm sure I'm going to fail because one thing I can say about my, my career path is that it's a bit odd and it diverges and it strays off strange tracks. And then so I really, it's very difficult for me to explain how I've got to where I've got to, but I will give it a bash. So I guess my primary area of work, the way I I guess, earn a crust is in policy. And I developed my skills in policy actually working for the primary environmental agency in New Zealand, which policy agency in New Zealand, which is the Ministry for the Environment. And I guess that's no coincidence because prior to starting at that ministry, I had already really developed a strong interest in environment. Not so much policy because I didn't really have any skills in that area, but I had a strong interest in environment and in particularly in environmental history, which for those of us who are not quite clear what that means, it really is just an exploration of the interaction between people and the environment over time. So how the environment shapes people and their behavior and their attitudes, and vice versa, how, of course, people have shaped the environment. So that's been an area of great fascination for me for some time now, but I came across it in one of those very strange, circuitous ways. I was researching a master's thesis, and then I went on to do a PhD thesis exploring attitudes to nature and wildlife, actually, specifically Asiatic black bears in the case of the PhD, in Japan. And in the course of doing that, it really kind of upended and exposed some assumptions I had about New Zealanders and our relationship with the environment, with nature, because I had assumed, like probably many actually, and particularly I guess of my generation, that we were very New Zealanders. We had lots of green space and lots of forests, and therefore we were very protective of nature, that we had a very positive attitude towards nature. And it was only really after I started reading, well, actually, a really important book to me, which I'm very happy to make reference to, is Environmental Histories of New Zealand. In fact, I'm just grabbing it from my shelf here. It's edited by geographer Eric Pawson and historian Tom Brooking. And reading that, which is a series of essays by various geographers and historians, I just found it utterly mind-blowing. And the level of destruction that humans and particularly Europeans in a relatively short time, particularly in respect to our forests and especially our lowland forests, our efficiency, if you can put it that way, in destroying these forests over a very short space of time, was impressive. if I may put it that way. And it certainly put New Zealanders' relationship with the environment for me in an entirely new light. And it completely upended and turned on the head, the assumptions I'd made. So that is, I guess, what discovering this history, very destructive history of ours, New Zealanders, with the environment, really made me want other New Zealanders to understand this. And that's kind of how I ended up on the path of writing about environmental history. And one thing I am very keen on in my books is to not make them academic. So even though they draw on all the relevant academic literature and research, I like to write them in such a way that an ordinary person off the street could pick up the book in a bookstore or in the library and read it and understand it. They don't need to have any prior knowledge, because I think it's really important that everyone who isn't inquisitive enough to read about it, can read it and understand it. So, yeah, that's kind of how I came to environmental history. And in my policy work I do, I still do a fair amount of environmental policy as part of my consulting, a little consulting company, KHM Consulting, working for local government, central government, and also trusts and that sort of thing. Also sometimes iwi organisations. Often this does have quite a strong environmental focus, but sometimes it also has a more a social focus. So it's, you know, can be any one of the well-beings, as they're called in local and central government parlance. So I guess I'm pretty adaptable in terms of my policy work.
Now, I believe, am I right in saying you live on a farm at the moment?
Yes. Saying that we live on a farm is possibly stretching it a bit. We live on a lifestyle block and we have sheep. We also have chickens and some dogs. But yes, we have a small block in the beautiful Pohangana Valley, which is around about 20 minutes or so out of Palmerston North in the North Island. And what actually attracted us to this block of land is that it's bordered on one side by a steep gully with a very small stream in the bottom. And that gully, because of its steepness, it retained much of its indigenous vegetation. It has at one time, it's clear, been burnt off, just as all the other forest around here was burnt. But it retains some native vegetation, and that's always a good basis to then start restoring do some more tree planting, etc., out on the flats, as we've done. We've planted hundreds and hundreds of trees since we first purchased the block. But it's always good to do it where there's already some remnant, because you have some idea of what grew here naturally. So that's what we've been doing, apart from growing some sheep, which are Wiltshire sheep, which are great for lifestyle block owners because you don't have to shear them. They shed, self-shedding
sheep. So they just basically mow your lawns and...
They mow our paddocks, that's right. And they're also nice animals. I have to say, we've also had a couple of cattle at one stage. One thing that we've really enjoyed and found rewarding about having a little farmlet is that we've got to know farm animals close up, and we've got to know them as individuals. And it is quite mind-blowing in the sense that they are all individuals, and as long as you interact with them in that way, you get to know them, you get to know their quirks, you watch their behaviours, and they've got some really interesting behaviours. You know, the way they communicate with each other, the way they communicate and interact with their babies, it's all really very, very interesting. And that has been eye-opening for us, previously being townies, realizing that, you know, we have these huge farms full of farm animals that we tend not to think about having individual behaviors or quirks, but actually they all do, given the chance, you know.
Want to make a comment about when you said, you know, about the impressive I guess destruction of our native forests and wetlands as well in New Zealand.
Absolutely.
We've made reference to this, in fact, quite a lot of times, but we had a guest a while ago now, last year, an environmental scientist from Queensland in Australia, and still to this day, 400,000 hectares of native bush and forest in Queensland alone is being cleared. So I don't know, I mean, there's not a lot left to be destructed in New Zealand, but I know that still does go on. But, you know, when we talk about that, and we say it sarcastically, obviously, tongue-in-cheek, impressive, but You know, that still continues in Australia and, of course, in other parts of the world as well. So, you know, we've been going on and on about the importance of native bush, native trees, wetlands, etc., and I'm sure we'll touch on that in a little wee while. You mentioned your consultancy and the work that you do. You're also co-founder of Better Futures Forum. The other co-founder being a very popular past guest of ours, Dr. Mike Joy. I'm sure we've asked the same question to him, but we'll ask you, how did that come about, Better Futures Forum?
Well, it was kind of very organic. It really came out, it sprung out of the opportunity that came about with basically when we were going into lockdown, it became obvious that we were going to go to level four. And I think this probably happened over much of the world, but it certainly happened in New Zealand. There was a huge amount of kind of media and social media discussion around, not going back to the old way, finding a new path. And I think what made it particularly kind of visceral and no longer just intellectual was that we found ourselves very suddenly living in a very different way. We weren't traveling long distances in our cars. We were working from home. We were something very dear to me. We were exploring neighborhood nature. We were spending quality time with our families. And I actually, when I say we, I have to be very swiftly that the lucky ones among us were able to do all these positive things. There were people for whom lockdown was a very unpleasant experience, especially if they were unfortunate enough to lose jobs. And also, I think it also led in some cases to people who are in less than optimal housing conditions to, you know, just increase stresses and, you know, that sort of thing. But for those of us who were lucky enough to have, you know, live in a nice place. And actually, this is something I did highlight, and I don't want to switch over to that prematurely, but it's something that I highlight in the epilogue of my Nature and Wellbeing book, that for those of us who lucky enough to live in nice places, it was actually a great opportunity to get out and explore nature around us, but you had to live in a nice place to do that. But anyway, getting back to Better Futures Forum, I think for the first time people thought, oh my goodness, you know, we could, well, of course, the other thing that was not happening over that time was also international travel, and no one was, it wasn't killing anyone not to travel overseas. Well, and hopefully in most cases. And, you know, people just found different ways of doing things. And of course, we all know the impact that also had on, you know, carbon emissions over that period. Although, you know, in the large scheme of things, that's only a tiny, tiny dent, unfortunately. But so it really, I guess, showed, it really seemed like it was like a spark. And so there were a number of us, and initially the conversation was between me and Mike, that thought, well, how about we seize this opportunity and say, yes, there is an alternative future, and this experience is giving us a glimpse of that alternative future. And I think what I liked about what we were doing was, instead of just the doom and gloom of, which, you know, and let's face it, it is pretty doomy and gloomy. So that's no criticism, but we tend to talk about, you know, if we carry on this path, all the ice is going to melt, the polar bears are going to die, and which unfortunately is also true. But it was really nice for a change to be able to fix on a positive alternative future that we were actually glimpsing, we were actually touching, it was within reach, and we thought it was just too good an opportunity to miss. So we sort of drew together a whole band of, we put the call out to experts from many fields, energy, transport, building, of course, the water space, land use, regenerative agriculture, all that sort of thing. And the energy was amazing. And also, I guess, because it coincided with people having a bit more time on their hands. They weren't necessarily working as much, or if they were working, they were working from home. So it was great. And it continues to this day, although, as we predicted, as things sort of went back to normal, in quote marks, more and more, it's obviously been a challenge to keep up that same level of energy that we had initially. But for anyone listening who is interested in what we're all about and becoming part of it, obviously would very much welcome them getting in touch. And if I remember it rightly, the URL for the website is bff.org. Has it got an NZ on the end?
.org.nz. .org.nz. And we'll link it in our show notes, so don't you worry.
That's probably a good way to sort of get in touch and see what we're all about.
Brilliant.
Now, you've touched on this quite a bit already in our talk today, nature and well-being. So when we expose ourselves to nature, it makes us feel good. And there's a lot of science to back that up too. Like, it improves circadian regulation, it can decrease stress, improve our immune function, it's good for the microbiome. Like, there's countless benefits to human health. And you've also touched on the fact that, you're lucky enough to live in a beautiful green space at the moment. But, most of the world are populated in urban areas, and really good urban development, planning for sustainable cities, they need to kind of factor in these green spaces. Can you tell us a little bit about that and your book?
Yeah, sure can. So, you're absolutely right. I'm so glad you rounded up all the benefits, because I don't have to do it. Spot on. Huge benefits of being in nature. And one thing that's probably really important to just note too, that the scientists and the researchers have done this, and there are a wealth of studies, you're absolutely right, a lot of them concentrated in North America, Europe, and to an increasing degree, Japan and Korea, actually, and particularly Korea, where forest therapy has become a really big thing.
Forest
actually.
Bathing, they even call it. I've
forest
seen
bathing,
recently.
Right.
Yeah.
So that began in Japan, but the Koreans have really taken it on board too, including the government. So, and they've set up all these forest therapy forests in Korea, South Korea, obviously. This is. It's a really the benefits are wide ranging, and what I just wanted to note too, because there've been people listening that go, well, obviously if you go out walking or running or bike riding in nature, there's also the physical, the fact that you're doing physical exercise, and of course that, as we all know, has many benefits. So the scientists who've done this research have been very careful to factor that out. Their studies have involved people doing either very, very light exercise, so just very slow walking, or just sitting in nature, so that they can make sure that they're factoring out the exercise component. And even there, they are finding, this broad range of benefits that that you've talked about, Emma, including boosts of immunity, improved mood, even improved cognition in certain groups, like those with ADHD, children with ADHD, or those suffering from depression, So it's pretty convincing, I have to say. In terms of opportunities to engage with nature, so one thing that I really emphasise in the book and is that in New Zealand we're very lucky that about a quarter of our land area is nature. It's either national or regional park. But the other thing we know, and I certainly am very aware of as an environmental historian, is the vast majority of those spaces also coincide. The reason why they exist and are still in nature, mainly forest, is because they are mountainous or hill country. Most of our national parks are mountain areas. And they were not preserved because our ancestors thought, well, you know, it's really important to have lots of nature for our well-being or for carbon sequestration or ecological reasons. They weren't thinking about that. It was simply just too hard to exploit these areas for other land uses and specifically agriculture, you know, on top of mountains or whatever. But what that means from a nature well-being perspective is that these areas, for many people, are a good couple of hours, if not more hours, drive away. You don't go into, they're also, you know, often quite rugged, steep areas. You need to have a certain level of preparation and fitness even to walk many of our, you know, bush areas or our nature areas. You can't just sort of bowl on out when you feel like it with very, you know, no prep and very limited fitness. You'd get into trouble quite quickly, as we know. So, and yet, around 86% of us live in urban areas, cities and towns. So where we really need nature to get the benefits of being in it regularly, because once a year, even for those lucky enough or who really love to get out tramping or whatever, you're probably only going to do it once, if maybe twice a year for any, you know, length of time, unless you're, say, retired or whatever. And so for most of us to get those benefits on a regular basis, we really need it nearby. It needs to be accessible. It needs to be safe for children and older people as well. So this really leads, from my perspective, to a call to do much more to restore nature in and around our urban areas. Places like river corridors, stream corridors, gully systems. Hamilton is one place that has been doing a really good job restoring its gully systems in the city. And of course, you know, there's reserves and things near cities where we can do a lot more and maybe do more to extend them. And a lot of people have been working on green corridors, which also tend to follow stream corridors. So this really leads, if we really want to see more opportunity for people to gain wellbeing benefits, including people that don't go on, you know, long tramping holidays, we really need to be doing more in creating more green space, a more green space that encourages, you know, more bird, natural bird life, supports ecosystems and so on, which will also have so many co-benefits, cleaner air, more, you know, better supported ecosystems, more bird life, more insect life, which is always good, cleaner water because of the filtering, and of course carbon sequestration, although we'd have to plant a lot of trees for that to really you know, gain benefits there. But so that is, I guess, probably the key message, is that our national parks are really, really good and we must take care of them and look after them. But we really need more nature in the places where the vast majority of us live.
So should we all be buying your book and then sending it to the urban planners at all our local councils?
Yeah. Totally. Or tell them to buy one.
I just want to add a couple of things there. I find it fascinating and almost hard to believe, but then I guess if you're taking the South Island as part of it, that 24% of our land, so basically a quarter, is effectively nature. Two things, and A, this is because I do go a lot into these areas, and I'm quite fortunate that I go almost every weekend. One, you know, we say, you're right. I mean, they are more technical areas, upper mountains, because too hard to go and put some poor cows or sheep up on those rugged places. But historically, we probably had less then because they're old mining areas and even logging. So if you look at places like the Coromandel, you look at Nelson, a lot of those places just come to mind now. They were actually cleared, or they were, and then it probably got too hard for them. But the other problem is that's also compounding the problem. In Auckland, we're actually surrounded by so many beautiful forests, and yet they're all closed now because of the Kauri dieback. And that's something that, as a trail runner, for myself living in Auckland, the biggest irony has been that I've got to continue travel out of Auckland, at least, like you say, 2 hours drive minimum to get somewhere because our forests are closed. So we might have the space, but like you say, accessibility, because some of it is technical, rocky, you know, footing is not, it's not the greatest. So, you know, if you're not very sure of yourself, you know, it's probably not ideal. And then secondly, well, it might be in your backyard, but you can't actually go in there anymore. I know Kauri dieback is affecting places in Whangarei even. So even through their sort of river section where they've got a beautiful trail that goes up into the hills, some Māori paths in there. Again, you're restricted in there. Waiheke Island. I mean, this is, you know, affecting a lot of places that perhaps people actually move to for exactly that reason. And now they've got that challenge. So it is quite difficult. This clean green image that we've busted quite a few times, but you know, being surrounded by green space is sometimes not as it's not what it seems a lot of times.
That's true. And yeah, you're absolutely right about Auckland. You're lucky, fortunate, despite Kauri dieback, which is an absolute tragedy, and let's hope that our clever scientists find a way to stop it. But you're absolutely right. But one thing that was a real revelation for me actually researching this book, because the major part of it is case studies. So looking at, you know, the experience of real New Zealanders, just ordinary New Zealanders. I know that's a problematic expression, but, you know, not necessarily mountaineers, and their experience of nature. And what I found really surprising is that, you know, when the likes of you guys, you're obviously very outdoorsy people, I'm relatively a little bit outdoorsy, and many of my friends are outdoorsy, and we tend to think that all New Zealanders are, you know, get out into nature, get out into, for example, if you lived in Auckland, you'd be out in the Waitakere's, especially if you lived in that area of Auckland, you'd be out there every weekend, right? Yeah. But one thing that was an absolute revelation for me, talking to people that worked with young people, I mean, the group that I looked at was more in the south of Auckland, but I heard many stories, particularly through Graham Dingle Foundation, that works with young people that have lots of potential but don't necessarily have the opportunity through their whatever family circumstances, socioeconomic situation, to have these opportunities. So Graham Dingle Foundation works to provide them. And one of the things is wilderness, this wilderness experience, and that they have, which is, I think, over about 3 weeks, and which includes a quite impressive tramp over the Kai Mai Mamaku ranges. Mm-hmm. And many of these kids have never, not only have they never been in bush or been on a bush walk, they have never slept in a tent, they have never slept under a night sky and seen the stars at night. Things that we might take for granted are not necessarily part of their world. And I also heard these stories, people in Christchurch, you know, kids, young people in Christchurch who lived not far from the sea there, but had never been to the sea. You know, they literally lived about 5 minutes car journey from the sea. So It's very easy for when you do have these just as a natural part of your life, your upbringing, the way you were brought up, you have these outdoor experiences to think that every New Zealander has them, and they don't, for reasons that are sometimes quite complex, sometimes a little bit cultural, sometimes to do with socioeconomics, whatever. And I think for me, it was a real revelation, and even more enforces the argument in that therefore we need more nature close by, and for communities where social cohesion is really important, that those green spaces, those natural spaces, need to also provide opportunity for social cohesion and cultural expression and things like that. And there's a couple of examples in Auckland where they've done this really well, actually, through urban design. They've restored the name of the project is, I'm just trying to rack my brain to remember it, and it will come back to me. But there's an example in Auckland. Oakley Creek is its English name, but it's also got a lovely Māori name, where they have done across a segment of it where there is a very wide range of people of different ethnic backgrounds, including Pasifika, where they've really incorporated cultural elements to encourage people of different ethnicities to use those spaces as places of for social gathering, social cohesion, and cultural expression. And I think we need to do a lot more thinking in this space too.
In Auckland, they've also got what they call the Te Puna Maunga Integrated Management Plan, which is basically, I'll probably get the number wrong, it's 13 or 14 of our Maungas. Maungas are our, I guess, well, in English, it's more a dormant volcanoes, but, you know, they're sort of sacred places in Maori culture. And they're doing a lot with that, where they've removed all the livestock from those volcanoes, yay, because you don't have to run through all their effluents. But they want to it's been quite contentious, removing some of the indigenous trees, but they want to reinstate and grow the native trees. They want to sort of make it more educational as well. So because it's quite sad. I think it's sad personally, where some of the little mongers are run up and beautiful views, and you can see pits, you know, that used to be maybe where they used to store their kumaras, their sweet potatoes, or their firearms, whatever it was, but there's nothing. It's just overgrown. And so they are, you know, and also they want to ensure that there's also shed space so you can still do some activities. But going back to your earlier point, so a lot of it is to do with accessibility, because, you know, well, I mean accessibility, but if you're living 5 minutes away from the beach, well, that's as accessible as it can be. But how important is it then for schools to sort of lead that? Because to be fair, I think my first experience as a kid sleeping in a tent or actually going in the bush was a school program, you know, where we went into the bush for a whole week and learned about fascinating stuff about wildlife. And this is in South Africa, so we actually had dangerous stuff out then. We still see outdoors. But that was my first experience. Even though I was very lucky growing up, my parents, very active as well, would drive 4 hours, would go in the mountains and make me, you know, tramp with them for a whole day until I had sore feet. But, you know, but for most, that was our first experience. So how important is it with schools then to... Whether it's a school, the school aligns with certain programs that drive that.
Yeah. I think it would be great if schools had the capacity and the latitude to do more of this outdoor. So obviously there's always been this component of outdoor education, but it's not quite the same as traditional outdoor education. It is sort of being out in these natural areas and learning, as you say, about ecosystem stuff, about maybe some bush skills, you know, that sort of thing. And it would be great if schools did more of this. I think, you know, preschools have actually been really good at teaching kids about the natural world, including getting out in it, you know, more and more. And I know there's lots of bush kindies, you know, there's lots of kindies in New Zealand that are really exploring the bush kindy kind of thing.
Gosh, gone are the days of just playing in a sandpit. That was my outdoor bush experience.
Exactly. But the problem, and I do have some insights because my husband is actually a long time school teacher and now a deputy principal at a school in New Zealand. So I do have quite a good understanding of the constraints from, you know, schools and teachers' perspective, that they, the pressure on them, especially, I mean, high school, as we know, there's a huge amount of pressure to get through the curriculum. The same can be said to a great degree in at primary school level, and also just, as you know, as you will know, the whole thing about hazards and health and safety, you know, even if you take your kids on a walking bus to the library, the forms that have to be sent home, the high vis jackets and, you know, this, that and the other. And so I think...
The bureaucracy is putting a lot of people off because it's too hard.
Exactly. And unfortunately, that responsibility falls on the teachers who already have so much to do. So I would love to see more of this happening, but I think we need to pull back a little bit. You know, I mean, the fact that until recently most schools were moving towards banning tree climbing for these reasons... gives you a bit of a sense. If you're going to ban tree climbing, well, you know, learning bush skills and living, you know, bivouacking out in the bush somewhere for a few days on end is probably not going to fly. So I do think we need to enable our schools and our teachers and our educators to give them the latitude to do a bit more of this, and where people say, yes, there is some risk, but there's also risk to staying at home or crossing the road, and it's about managing it. So, yes, I totally agree with you, and I particularly think for those kids who have less opportunity through family circumstances, having these opportunities through school is it all the more important. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Let's shift gears just a little bit. Apologies if I'm butchering the pronunciation here, but let's talk about your Ho'oro yoga.
Yes.
I've got it.
Well done, Emma.
Well, not that I'm an expert.
Yeah, the Aussie. Yeah.
Becoming a Kiwi by the day.
Yeah, I'm slowly getting there. So I watched your Brilliant Farm yoga recently. Ben linked it to me. And I know it can be viewed as a little bit cheeky and everyone thought it had a humorous message, but the message can be really important. Like, there's some really important takeaways from that, and I just wanted to touch on how yoga can actually align really beautifully with environmental stewardship. So when most people think of yoga, they just think of the physical aspect of, you know, doing the poses on your mat, but yoga goes a lot deeper than that. That's, you know, only one of the eight limbs of yoga. And so the ethical code of conduct for a yogi, like the yamas and the niyamas, they really support conservationship and sustainability and basically everything that, you know, you've got that fire in your belly for. So was that kind of a natural fit for you?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, I totally agree. Certainly yoga does encourage you to think about your place in the universe, doesn't it? And I think you're absolutely right. For some people, obviously, they are attracted, and I have to confess, I originally was too. I was attracted to yoga for the physical benefits, but more and more, I have really become so much more aware of the benefits for mental well-being through breath, you know, pranayama, and this is sort of moving slightly away from the nature thing, but I also think when I have a yoga session and people come along, I think it gives them the space. It's very, very non-judgmental. Everyone is doing things at their own pace, and they are encouraged and supported in that environment you know, we are our own most critical critics, aren't we, as human beings, particularly in the West, I think. And yoga, well, at least the way I do it, it really encourages people to be easy on themselves, and particularly the style of yoga that I practice, which is Hatha. It's actually all about internal sensation. It's not about posing in front of a mirror, finding perfect form. So I think, you know, that's something that really attracts me, and I've become more and more attracted to, because I've seen it reflected in the people that come and experience yoga with me, that they, you know, overall there's this sort of kind of glow of well-being at the end of a session. But yes, I do think there's a huge amount of scope with, you know, this alignment between nature stewardship yoga, and actually in a more kind of tangible way, one of my favorite ways of doing yoga that I do mainly down on the Kauai coast is outdoor yoga. So I have sessions over the summer where I just, people come along, they pay a koha gold coin to participate, and really even that's very you know, neither here nor there as far as I'm concerned, and we do yoga outdoors. And for a lot of people, it's even, you know, some may have never done yoga before, even those who have done yoga before, it's quite a different experience, because you're really tuning into sounds, sensations, breeze, the sun on your eyelids, and so it's quite special. So that's kind of a connection, the nature and well-being. That's probably the strongest connection I have with between nature and well-being and yoga is the outdoor yoga, which I really love.
And I've got to say, I've heard of puppy yoga before and goat yoga, but after watching the video, I think chicken yoga might take off a little bit.
Yeah, totally. I think the chickens wised up after one, that they said, no, we're not being exploited in this way.
I was about to say, you have very patient chickens.
To do Warrior 3.
And you say connecting with nature. If you're doing yoga on the Kapiti Coast, it's more about sand being blown into your eyes, and it's probably all those
it would if it was on the beach, but I'm pretty smart, and we do it by the river. And yeah, so it's actually very green, and we've got a little sheltered spot in the trees. So yeah, no sand is involved.
Oh, look, but I do have to agree though, because one of the I think having spent a bit of time in Brisbane, you know, a lot of the free yoga classes are, well, the weather's conducive for it, outdoors, and all you're hearing are the birds, and it's sunset, and it is a very different feeling than being in an enclosed, air-conditioned, sweat-smelling, you know, class. Yeah. This whole connection with nature and you know, is hugely important. So the next thing is okay, so our listeners, predominantly New Zealand, Australia, but we've got from all over the world. They've listened to this podcast, they're feeling inspired. It's like, yep, I need to get out. So step number one, buy the book. Step number two, okay, what can we do as individuals, or how can we contribute to perhaps ourselves and our immediate sort of loved ones, our kids, our partners, our parents, etc., even our local community? What can we do to get out there and be more connected?
Yeah, particularly with nature, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, look, one thing, and I think that was a positive from the lockdown experience, was that you'll be surprised. So many people, well, in New Zealand anyway, we default, if we're going to go do something outdoors, we hop in our car first, right? But it's amazing when you go for a walk or hop on your bike, what little nooks and crannies, little green spaces you are likely to find, and it's better for you, and it's better for the planet, because you're not getting in a car. But it can also lead to little discoveries where you think, wow, okay, I didn't know this was here, but couldn't it be improved if we did a bit more planting? You might want to then you know, contact a community group or your council and say, hey, you know, we could do so much more in this little space where there's a bit of nature, but it's been a bit neglected. It could lead to something much bigger. It could also lead to connecting with your community, doing something that's intergenerational, older people, younger people together. So many things can spring out of something like that, just getting out and exploring. I also think there's so many opportunities in specific, particularly in neighbourhood nature. One of the things that really went crazy during lockdown apparently was, and I'm just going to dig into my memory for the app. It's an international app where you log, where you log sightings of a bug or a bird or a nature. Oh, damn, it's not coming to me, but it will. That went crazy over lockdown too. Lots of people getting out and finding things and logging them in this app. And I think the more we get out, the more we will see, especially if you have children, but even as adults, that there are opportunities to discover things that are right literally under your nose. You know, yeah. Animals, plants, relationships, you know, ecosystem relationships between animals and plants and things that are right there. And this also, knowing they are right there, kind of nurtures that sense of, hopefully, of responsibility to continue, for them to continue to be there and to be nurtured and to find ways to make the ecosystems around us healthier. So that would be one thing. And I think also just letting your local council know that you think, not just green space for playing sport. Sport is really important and I'm all for sport, but also green space that allows some wildness to, you know, have space. Not all manicured, not all, you know, weed sprayed, but, you know, some spaces where we can have nature doing its own thing, you know, that we want more of that around where we live. And giving councils your support for that to happen and budget to be put towards that is another really potent way, I think, too.
Yeah. Oh, look, I totally agree. And look, as someone who spends many hours on trails and hates running on the road now, for many reasons, especially lockdown, it did make me realize how many hidden away little reserves are hidden, but they're hidden within cities. You know, mm-hmm. You've got to go down a cul-de-sac, which you think is just a cul-de-sac, but there's a little path mm-hmm. that leads down to a stream that, wow, there's a path. Okay, it's only 800 meters long, but I managed to connect a lot of these little reserves where almost 2/3 of a long run would actually be off-road. So there are a lot of little backyard sort of, that's just trees on someone else's property. No, that's probably a little reserve. So there's actually a lot more than we realize. And you're right, leave the car, even leave the bike, just get on your feet and just start exploring. And you'll be amazed, especially when you live in the middle of a city. If you're in the outskirts, actually, ironically, it can sometimes be harder if it's just farmland and there's no trees in the area.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, actually, it is ironically harder because often country roads are actually quite dangerous. You know, they're open roads, there's trucks, things like that, and no footpaths. So, yeah, cities are great for that. And the app that I was thinking of, by the way, was iNaturalist, which you may have heard of, or your listeners no doubt will have heard of. And apparently that went through a real boom during lockdown with people logging all these discoveries they've made. Often with their kids, which is what you want.
And we saw a lot of that.
The last app that had a lot of people out in the parks that I can recall was Pokemon Go, because they were all
I was just gonna say so people are good at hunting things
for technology somewhere.
Yeah, totally.
Now, you've had you've been doing a little bit of a book tour around New Zealand, sort of promoting your latest book, Nature and Wellbeing in Aotearoa. You've got one more coming up
Yes, I've got one more at least. So this one is in Nelson, 4th of March. It is in partnership with, and I think I've got their name right, it's the Nelson Science Society. And I unfortunately can't tell you the venue. I can't quite remember what it is, but there will be details up. So if people are in and around Nelson, they will see this. They can also follow Totara Press, Totara as in the tree, if they're on Facebook, that is, and the details will be up there soon too. But yeah, right. So yeah, look out for that if you're a Nelson person or nearby.
And again, we'll link that in the show notes.
Excellent, sure. Excellent.
No, Catherine, it's been an absolute, an absolute pleasure, because a lot of our, I always say this, after a good, positive feeling show like this, but a lot of, and you mentioned this yourself right at the beginning, is a lot of our episodes do sometimes come across as the doom and gloom, because we're all about what is actually going on in the world. But there's a lot we can still do for mental and physical well-being. And that's just connecting with nature. And one of my favorite things is actually going barefoot in a forest or on trail walks. And I did that recently on an island outside of Whakatane, and it's amazing, just that experience, just connecting straight down to the ground. It could be a little bit slower in some tricky sections, but it's amazing. And I think this book really is just, it's beautiful. There's a lot of beautiful imagery. It's not just words, there's a lot of pictures. I highly, highly recommend getting a copy of this. Yes, it's New Zealand, but it's a lot you can relate to from other parts of the world for sure. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing that positive energy, your knowledge and insight into our history of New Zealand is also amazing. So thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Thank you, Ben and Emma, for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.